The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to the City Bible Forum. It's probably time we got the show on the road. Hopefully a few more will join us in just a moment. My name is Peter Caldor, if we haven't met before. And today we're very grateful that our speaker, Mark Gilbert, has stepped in at the last minute. You may or may not be aware that there was a slightly different plan announced for this week, but our speaker had to be rushed to hospital and get his appendix out. So we're very grateful that Mark has stepped in. Our speaker, Mark, is an Anglican minister from Freshwater. Freshwater is near Manly on the northern beaches of Sydney. And Mark is speaking from the topic, From Sinner to Saint. And we're going to be looking at a part of the Bible that comes from Luke's Gospel, Luke's account of Jesus. And you can see in your program that we're looking at the end part of Luke from the 23rd chapter. Well, you may wish to follow along as I now read from what's printed inside the program, and then I'll invite Mark up to come and address us. Two others who were criminals were led away to be put to death with him. And when they came to the place that is called the Skull, there they crucified him, and the criminals, one on his right and one on his left. And Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And they cast lots to divide his garments. And the people stood by, watching. But the rulers scoffed at him, saying, He saved others, let him save himself, if he is the Christ of God, the Chosen One. The soldiers also mocked him, coming up and offering him sour wine, and saying, If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself. There was also an inscription over him, This is the King of the Jews. One of the criminals who was hanged railed at him, saying, Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us. But the other rebuked him, saying, Do you not fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we are receiving the due rewards of our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong. And he said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And he said to him, Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. Mark, perhaps as Mark is coming up, just a quick question. This title that you've come up with, From Sinner to Saint, it's rather intriguing. Did you have anything or person in mind in particular when you came up with this title?
I don't think you get too many prizes for guessing that the topic of saint has been about in the media over the last few weeks, and the fact that the Roman Catholic Church is declaring or elevating Mary MacKillop to be Australia's first saint from the Catholic Church, for me, has got me thinking. I grew up in a Catholic church, and I was in the Catholic Church for about 30 years, and the topics of what is a sinner and what is a saint and how can I be acceptable to God and know that I'm going to heaven are all things that it's got me thinking about. So I wanted to share with you today some things that I've found from the Bible about what it says about what sinners are and saints are and how we can be acceptable to God. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, we look forward to that. And thanks again, Mark, for stepping in at the short notice.
It's a pleasure. Mary MacKillop was a remarkable woman. As I mentioned, you're probably going to hear quite a bit about her in the next few weeks as she's going to be declared to be a saint by the Catholic Church on the 17th of October. She was born about 170 years ago in a poor family in Melbourne. And by the time that she was 14 years old, she had to work to support her family. By the time she was 18, she actually had to leave home with a couple of her brothers and sisters and move to rural Victoria, some hundreds of miles away from her family, the rest of her family, and she worked as a governess there for several years. And it was in that rural town that when she was 24 years of age, together with a couple of her brothers and sisters, actually started a school for poor children. She started the school with 60 children, and within 6 months there were over 200 children in her school. Such was the demand for education, particularly amongst the poor in rural parts of Australia at that time. The thing that's particularly remarkable about Mary MacKillop is that within 2 years, over 100 other single women had followed her example, and there were now 17 of these different institutions right across mainly rural Australia teaching poor kids how to read and write. Mary MacKillop, when she started teaching this school, actually did it as a nun, even though she hadn't been ordained at that stage. She was later ordained. And most of the women who followed her example did that as well. So that by the time Mary MacKillop was 27 years old, she was the leader of the First Order of Australian Nuns. Quite a remarkable thing to have achieved by the time you're 27. Perhaps even more remarkable was that by the time she was 29, she'd been excommunicated for failing to follow a bishop's order. And by the time she was 31, she'd actually travelled herself by boat to Rome to meet the Pope to have her group of nuns officially recognised as a community, as an order within the Catholic Church. It's an amazing story, and I thank God for the things that Mary MacKillop and other men and women like her have done for the poor and disadvantaged, particularly kids in our country, teaching them how to read and write. It's a wonderful thing. But when I compare my life with hers, particularly when I think about what it means to be acceptable to God, because as far as the Catholic Church is concerned, her becoming a saint is the Church saying she's definitely in heaven. Okay? When I compare my life to hers, and if that's what's required to be sure that you're going to heaven, well, I think my life is a pretty miserable failure. And I dare say there'd be probably more than a few other people in this room, if we compared our lives to someone like Mary MacKillop, we'd find ourselves falling well short. In the end, the story of Mary MacKillop does leave me feeling a bit guilty and depressed as I look at my life. I grew up in a good Catholic family, and the problem that I struggled with growing up was, how could I be acceptable to God when I kept sinning? Because I knew my faults and failings better than anyone else. No matter how hard I tried not to sin, I kept doing the same things over and over again. This was only reinforced when I went to confession, because it would be the same list every time when I confessed my sins to the priest. There were a number of particularly memorable religious experiences I had growing up as a Catholic, school retreats and conventions like the World Youth Day that we've seen here in Sydney a few years ago. There was one about 20 years ago that I was involved in. I even got to shake hands with the Pope. At these religious sort of experiences and retreats, I generally have an experience of feeling really close to God, being very aware of how much he loved me. But at the same time, I'd also be aware of how far short I fell of his standards. So as a result of these retreats, I would make resolutions to pull up my socks and try harder and be better at living the way that God wants me to live. And then 6 or 12 months later, there'd be another religious retreat that I would go on, and I'd sort of look at how I'd gone over the last 12 months, and usually I'd actually been worse when I thought of how good God was and how I behaved. I kept falling short of the standards. In the end, I started to dread these sorts of religious experiences, because I knew when I'd have them, I'd feel great about how good God was, I'd feel lousy about how bad I was, and there was no solution offered as to how a sinful person like me, who kept struggling with sin, could be acceptable to God. I did find an answer to that question. I found that answer in the Bible. One of the places in the Bible that I think answers this question is the passage that we had today, but there are many others. So if this is an issue and a question for you, I'd encourage you to speak with me, read the Bible more, because I think in many places throughout the Bible there's an answer to that question. How, as a sinful person who keeps struggling with sin, we can be acceptable to God. The passage that we're looking at today is actually about Jesus' death and the death of two other men, a situation where two men have been completely defeated by sin, two criminals, and they meet God, they meet Jesus, all brought together in the most extreme of circumstances. They are all about to die. Sin is a reality in this world. It affects all of us. In another part of the Bible written by the Apostle John, he says, He who says he has no sin deceives himself, and the truth is not in him. Sin is a reality that affects each and every one of our lives. In God's mind, we are all sinners. Sin in the Bible is an attitude. It's rejecting God's good rule over our lives and shaking our tiny fists at him and saying that we know better. Sin is more than just breaking the rules. Sin is rejecting the rule maker and making up our own rules. Sin at its heart is rebellion against the king. God's rules are pretty simple. The version that Jesus authorised in Luke's account of Jesus' life was this. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind. And love your neighbour as yourself. Let's just spend a few moments thinking about how we've gone at keeping these rules over the last few days, over the last week. Have you loved your neighbour as much as you've loved yourself? Have you given them the things that you want to have as well, all the time? Have you shared opportunities for success at work? Have you wanted them to succeed as much as you? Have you wanted them to enjoy the quality of relationships that you have? Have you wanted them to be as well off as you are? Have you desired or lusted after things or people that you shouldn't? How is lusting after someone else in their best interests? Have you been quickly angry with someone? We hate it when people get unjustly angry at us, but how have you gone at holding back your tongue and your actions when someone does something that absolutely frustrates you? When you're driving on the road, for example, and someone cuts in front of you. Have you spoken badly to people around you? And what about how you've treated God? He made you. You owe him your life. Have you lived your life in the last week doing what he wants, or have you been doing mainly what you want? Have you thanked him for all of the good things that he's given you in the last week? Have you given him the credit for the success that you've had and the clever things that you've been able to do this week? Or have you claimed the credit for yourself? Sin is a power that takes over all our lives. It leads us to do things that we were not made for. It wrecks the good lives that God has given us. And sin has a powerful leader, Satan. We all make choices about who we follow, and when we sin, we follow Satan. So sin is this external power that impacts on us every single day of our lives. But sin also comes from deep within, our thoughts, our desires, our passions. Made good by God, are all affected by sin. We actually want to sin. So sin is this internal power as well. Sin is such a great power that we are too weak to fight it. Think about the last time that you tried to stop doing something that you knew you shouldn't. New Year's resolutions are often a good illustration of this. We, at the beginning of the year, often in our cultures, think of a list of things that we want to change this year and do better. When I spoke about this subject once before, I said I'd never met anyone that had kept their New Year's resolutions for a month, let alone a year. And of course, someone came up to me afterwards and said, I have actually kept my New Year's resolution for a year. It was the first person I'd ever met that had done so. But it's hard, isn't it? We really struggle to be able to stop doing things that we know that we shouldn't do. When it comes to the battle between us and sin, we're not strong enough to fight that battle. We need someone to save us. We need help, or we're all going under. Now, many blokes I know like to be able to do things for themselves. When I go to Bunnings, I hate to ask the shopping assistant where the spanner is. And much to my wife's and kids' frustration, after about 10 or 15 minutes, I finally give in and ask someone, and it usually turns out okay. It's like that with sin. If we think that we can conquer sin on our own by trying harder, then we're kidding ourselves. Here in our passage today, we've got two men whose lives have been completely destroyed by sin. Men who have hurt other people and are receiving justice for what they have done. Ultimate justice. Death. What do you think we deserve for our sin? Do you think saying sorry and doing a few good things will make up for all of the things that we've done? What do you think we deserve for ignoring God? He made us. All life comes from God. If we ignore God, then one day he's actually going to respect our decision and ignore us as well. That's a problem when we even rely on God to be able to breathe. Death is the price that all of us pay for sin. We die because we sin. Sin is that serious. The Apostle Paul, when he's talking about the subject to Christians in Rome in the first century, says that just as sin came into the world and death through sin, so death spread to all people because all have sinned. Sin is a massive problem. We should never underestimate it. What will you say to God when you face him, when you die, as someone who's been completely defeated by sin? I'm afraid that saying sorry and offering a few good actions might not be enough. Our passage today, a very grim scene. Two others who were criminals were led away to be put to death with him. And when they came to the place that's called the skull, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on his right and one on his left. And Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Three men being led out to public execution. We've got some idea of the barbarity of the situation. And we read Jesus' words about the men that are about to kill him. He says, "Father, forgive them." I don't know why was forgiveness so much on Jesus' mind when he's about to die. It'd be the last thing I'd be thinking of if someone was about to nail me to a cross. Well, let's keep reading. Sentence 34, and Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And they cast lots to divide his garments. And the people stood by watching, but the rulers scoffed at him, saying, "He saved others. Let him save himself, if he is the Christ of God, his chosen one." And the soldiers also mocked him, coming up and offering him sour wine and saying, "If you are the king of your Jews, save yourself." There was also an inscription above him that read, "This is the king of the Jews." One of the criminals who were hanged railed at him, saying, "Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us." Now, I'd like us to notice that in this passage, two words keep coming up, or two ideas keep coming up. The first word is save, and the second word or idea is king or Christ. Everyone is expecting Jesus to save people. The people watching Jesus crucified say, "He saved others, let him save himself." The soldiers say, "Save yourself." Even one of the criminals dying next to Jesus says, "Save yourself and us." And people have got good reason to expect that Jesus will save people, because Jesus actually tells us that that's what he came to do. Again, in Luke's account of Jesus' life, we have Jesus' words, "For I came to seek and save what was lost." That is the reason that Jesus came to earth. But these people don't really believe that Jesus can save. They're taunting him. They're provoking him. Their words are people that don't really believe that Jesus can save, because they don't really believe that a man there dying on a cross has got the power to be able to do it. Which is where the second word comes into play. The word king or Christ. Christ isn't Jesus' surname. Christ is a title. It means king or appointed ruler. Bit like the way that we used to use the term Elizabeth Rex. You don't hear it spoken about these days very much anymore, but Elizabeth Rex means Elizabeth Ruler or Elizabeth the Queen. So Jesus Christ means Jesus the King. People don't believe that Jesus has got the power to save because they don't really believe that Jesus is this powerful King. The people say, "If he's the Christ, whom God has chosen, and the soldiers say, "Save yourself if you are the king of the Jews." And they put a sign up above his head that says, "This is the king of the Jews." That wasn't them finally realising that Jesus was this great king. That sign was put up by the Romans. The Romans were the occupying forces in Jerusalem. And it's a taunt, it's a joke. They're oppressing the Jewish people at that time in history, and they're saying that if this guy is the best king you muster, well, look, we've just killed him. Aren't we great? Okay, it's a joke. They don't really believe that Jesus is the king. Even one of the criminals next to Jesus says, "Aren't you the Christ?" if Jesus was this Christ, this great king, then people are right to expect that Jesus could do something about the situation that he was in. Because in the Old Testament, the promises of God, written hundreds of years before Jesus was born, God promises to send a great king. A king who will have more power than any other king that has ever lived. A king that will save his people from all powers and enemies that might afflict them. A king who will set up a great kingdom and a king who will live forever. Surely if Jesus was this king, then something small like a crucifixion wouldn't really cause him any trouble. So we've got these two words, king and save. And we've got two responses. One response we've seen already, and that's not to trust Jesus, and so far that's everyone's response. People don't believe that Jesus can save anyone, let alone himself, and people don't really believe that Jesus is a king. That's response number one. But I'd like us to look closely at response number two, the last criminal, the man whose life has been destroyed by sin and who's facing the fair punishment for his sin. Whatever you think of the death penalty, this criminal himself thinks he's getting what's fair for what he's done. We never are told what he's actually done. Verse 40. But the other criminal rebuked him, saying, "Do you not fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we are receiving the due reward for our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong." And he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." This criminal does three things right. First of all, he admits that he's getting what he deserves. He admits that he's been completely overpowered by sin. He also recognises that Jesus isn't getting what he deserves. He's innocent and doesn't deserve to die. So he admits that he's been overpowered by sin. The second thing this criminal does is he believes that Jesus can save him. He asks Jesus, he said, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." He knows that Jesus can get him out of this mess. He's not trying to deal with the situation on his own. This belief, this reliance, this trust is what faith is all about. It's admitting that we are helpless and trusting the only one who can save us. So he admits and then he believes. The third thing he does is he commits himself to Jesus' kingdom, to the great promised king, the one God has sent to save his people. He wants to be in Jesus' kingdom. "Remember me when you come into your kingdom, where you are the king." And Jesus does save this man. Sentence 43, and he said to him, "Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise." This one man, one of the few people in the Bible we're actually told is definitely in heaven, a saint, we'll compare him to someone like Mary MacKillop. Because I think this man highlights one of the most important differences between Catholics and Protestants. For Catholics, faith in the end is something that you do to be good. For Protestants, faith is simply trusting that Jesus has done everything to save us. It's that simple trust that Jesus has paid for your sins, past, present, and future. It's that assurance that you are going to heaven, because it all depends on Jesus, not us. Jesus came to save people from the greatest power in this world, the power of sin. He came to save people from the power of sin by forgiving them. That's why forgiveness is so much on Jesus' mind as he's about to die. But Jesus can only forgive sins if he pays the price. That's why he died on the cross. The sad, sad irony of this passage is that while people are taunting Jesus for not being able to save people and not being even able to save himself, Jesus is doing the one thing that can actually save them. He's paying the price for their sin by dying in their place. He's saving them by not saving himself. I'll explain a bit more what I mean. When I sin, I hurt someone. I do damage. I also hurt God. For that sin to be forgiven, a cost needs to be paid. The cost for our sin is that Jesus died to pay for our sin so that we don't have to. But you've got to trust that he can do it. You have to trust that he's the powerful king. I mentioned earlier that one of the things I couldn't understand about God was, how could I be acceptable to him while I kept struggling with sin? The answer is Jesus. Jesus is more powerful than my sin. That means that when I sin, I'm still acceptable to God because it doesn't depend on me and my power not to sin. It depends on Jesus and his power. There's nothing I need to do to add to what Jesus has done to pay for my sins, like confession or penance or doing good things or other religious acts. To add things to what Jesus has done is to really say, I don't trust you, Jesus, that you've done everything to deal with my sins. I've got to do my bit as well. Saving people is all up to Jesus. That's why Jesus can say to a convicted criminal that has done nothing himself to deal with his sin, he says to that convicted criminal, today, I tell you, you'll be with me in paradise. I'm acceptable to God as a sinner because my King Jesus has saved me. I trust that. Of course, I don't go out looking for sin anymore. In fact, I try even harder not to sin, to honour and obey my King, because that's what he wants. But sin is no longer a barrier between me and God. I'm certain where I stand with God even when I sin, because Jesus has died to save me. I'm certain that I'm going to heaven. Now, that might sound like a pretty arrogant statement if you understand what I'm saying is I'm certain I'm going to heaven because I'm good enough. No, I'm certain that I'm going to heaven because Jesus has done everything to get me there. How will you respond to Jesus today? As Billy Joel put it, will you laugh with the sinners and trust that Jesus has done everything to deal with your sins? Or will you cry with the saints who keep trying harder to please God but never make the grade?
Looks like we've got a couple of questions rolling in there. I'll just give Mark a moment to look at that. And while he does, as I mentioned at the outset, we do have these complimentary copies of Luke's Gospel at the back, if you'd like to pick those up. Luke is obviously what we've looked at today, Luke chapter 23.
We have one question, but if you want to ask me a question as well, either here or afterwards, I'm around. What do you mean by faith without works is nothing? I'm not sure that I said that, actually. If I did, you probably have misunderstood me. Faith or believing or trusting that Jesus has done everything to deal with our sin, that he's saved us, that he's given us eternal life, can't be a mere intellectual exercise. Okay? It's got to affect the way that we relate to God, and it's got to affect the way that we relate to the people that God loves, our neighbours. However, it's not our actions that get us into that relationship in the first place. Okay? It's trusting Jesus and what he's done and realising that results in our salvation. Our good works, our actions, our things that we do in relationship to God and to other people are our response to what God has done for us. It doesn't earn us a place in heaven. It's just what we do because we realise who Jesus is. It's just living out what you believe. Yep. Anyone want to come back at me on that one? It's an important topic and question that lots of people talk about and wrestle with. So the criminal on the cross, he didn't do anything. He trusted Jesus. That was enough. I'm sure, having realised who Jesus was, if he ever got a chance to get off the cross, he would have lived differently. But we don't get to hear about that.
Mark will be here for a few minutes, not for too long. I think he'll be able to stay for a few minutes if you'd like to catch him. Next week, we do start an 8-week series with Al Stewart, and we actually are looking at Luke's Gospel. If you do want to perhaps read ahead, it's just 3 or so chapters out of Luke's Gospel, from chapter 9, more or less, through to about chapter 12, that we'll be looking at over the next 8 weeks. If you want to read ahead. Otherwise, have a great afternoon and hope to see you next week.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.